Morning, everybody. How you doing? That sure looks like fun. I'd like to throw color around like that. That's pretty cool. And the park is fun, too, apparently. I take no credit for the video. That's just John's crazy. We're both crazy. We are looking forward to hanging out with you guys today. Hope that you'll come out for that. But why don't we dive in today into our series on the Gospel of Mark. And I have a question that I want you to consider as I start. And you just have to kind of think back in your memory banks to an occasion when you witnessed a large storm. Can you remember in your life if you've ever weathered like a really fierce one? In Oklahoma, where my dad is from, my grandpa would call it a gully washer. A monster storm. If you've ever weathered a storm, you've probably weathered multiples. Then you know that weather like that, the violence of that can be pretty scary, especially if it's like a tornado threat or a hurricane or something like that. And you've probably experienced some severe weather in your life, and I have too. And I wanted to share with you just a couple of my storm stories. Do you mind? I'll throw one out there. The first one happened whenever I was in the second grade. I lived at the time right across the street from the elementary school that I attended. And it was the afternoon. I remember that distinctly because school was supposed to be ending. And I was ready for school to be over. And the teacher in my class was being agitated, was not acting like everything was okay. And I remember her getting our attention as a class right here at the end of the day and asking us to quickly go into the hallway. And we found that when we got there that all the other classrooms were doing the same. And they were instructing us, she was telling us, turn and face the walls, get down on your knees and cover your head. There's a really bad storm coming in, and this is where we're going to take shelter. Now, while the rest of my class did as they were told, I reminded my teacher, very helpfully, I thought, that I lived right across the street. It's the end of the school day. I live right across the street. I could just go home for this. And she asked me at the time, very intently, do you have a basement? And I said, yeah, I do. We have a basement. And I was 7 years old. And my teacher released me to go home when there's a tornado watch and all the rest of my classmates are huddled in the hallways. Now, what you need to know about me is I was completely oblivious to the fact that there was a storm. I just wanted to go home. And so when I got home, I didn't go down to my basement. I went to the backyard and I started playing. I think it could be said that I didn't understand the severity of the situation. In my teacher's defense, I'm sure that she no doubt thought that, that she was interested in my safety, that she thought that a basement would be safer than being huddled in a hallway at a school. But I was 7 years old, and she released me to go across the street. So while my classmates remained huddled in the hallway across the street, I was climbing trees in my backyard, and I remember staring intently at the sky because it was this mysterious shade of green, and I just thought that was marvelous. This is crazy. So I went all the way to the top of a tree and was just looking at it. And the next week, my parents drove us by the homes that had lost their roofs, which were two blocks from my house. And I had remained in the backyard through the whole thing, just like hanging out in the tree. I didn't tell them that. Because even at 7 years old, I was still aware that that probably would not go over well. That's one storm that I distinctly remember as a kid. The second storm that comes to mind for me occurred whenever I was at summer camp. And I was in high school, and it was an old campground. It seems like all campgrounds are old. But this one was exceptionally old. All the buildings had corrugated metal roofs, and none of them had, glass pane windows or enclosures in any way. They're all open air with, the metal screens in there. And the only way that you could really secure any of the buildings on campus was if you went outside the building and they had these, you know, these big door flaps that were anchored up at the top with like those little hook clasps, and you had to undo the clasp, and you actually had to get on a ladder to do it because they were so high up, and then you'd lower the things down and they'd make a huge boom, and then you could enclose the whole building. But this storm on this particular occasion came so quickly, there was no time for battening down the hatches. It was just get inside and hold on to something. And I remember that the look on the counselors' faces scared me immensely, because as the clouds darkened and they were roiling. I don't know if you've ever seen clouds that actually just like they're spinning and it's a tumult, and it was an ominous looking storm. And if the counselors were scared, then I was scared. And that, like I said, there weren't any really safe places to take shelter, and so instead, all of us were kind of, you know, glued to the screens, because we could see it was a wide open field at this camp, and we were watching the storm, you know, advance towards us like a wall of water. You could just see the water. You know how when you could see the water coming, and it was just roaring at us really fast and coming right across the field, and we could see the rain hammering down. And sure enough, as soon as it hit, the wind just blew the rain and the water inside those screens, and we were all soaked because we were standing out there looking at them, and it's like, you know, the water hits us. And the only thing louder than the sound of the tomahawk torrents of rain hitting that metal corrugated roof was when a lightning bolt hit in the field about 50 yards out in front of us, right smack, and I watched it hit, and it just cracked like nothing I'd ever heard, so loud. And it sounded like a dumpster had been dropped about 10 stories onto the asphalt below. Just a metallic boom. It was crazy. And that was a scary fright. I think we all like leaped under bunk beds at the, yeah, you know, diving for cover anywhere we could. And we rode out the storm, but it was an awesome, awesome storm to be a part of. Nasty weather. You've been in it. I've been in it. It can scare us. It certainly gets our attention. And I'm sure you've got a story like mine, maybe even better than mine. A storm, a large one, can make us feel powerless. It can cause us to tremble, because there is nothing that we can do about that. Nothing that we can do. And I suppose that's probably why it's easy for us to identify with Jesus' disciples when we read about their encounter with some violent weather. And it takes place in Mark chapter 4, verses 35 through 41. I want to read it for us, and it'll be on the screens if you want to follow. Mark writes this. He says, "As evening came, Jesus said to his disciples, 'Let's cross to the other side of the lake.' And so they took Jesus in the boat, and they started out, leaving the crowds behind, although other boats followed. But soon a fierce storm came up. High waves were breaking into the boat, and it began to fill with water. Jesus was sleeping at the back of the boat with his head on a cushion. And the disciples woke him up, shouting, 'Teacher, don't you care that we're going to drown?' When Jesus woke up, he rebuked the wind and said to the waves, 'Silence, be still.' Suddenly the wind stopped, and there was a great calm. Then he asked them, 'Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?' The disciples were absolutely terrified. 'Who is this man?' they asked each other. 'Even the wind and waves obey him.'" We're currently in the middle of our summer series. It's a series of messages from this book of Mark. And today is our fourth one in this gospel. And as a companion to this, we're also reading through Jesus the King, which is a book by Tim Keller. And Mr. Keller is very insightful, so he helps us, I confess, to pilfering a whole bunch of his good stuff for you today. But the Gospel of Mark is actually an account. It's a historical account of the life of Jesus. And as we progress through the book, our hope at Harbor for you guys is that you'll begin to develop a very clear picture of who he is, what Jesus taught, what he did, and why it matters. Not just head knowledge, but why it's significant for us. That's kind of what we're after. And Mark happens to be the oldest written record of the life of Christ. You know, we've got four gospel accounts. Those are all documents that would have given us the record of what Jesus did. And Mark's is the oldest one. Last week, Kelly shared, she's our Kids Harbor director, regarding an incident that happens just before this, Jesus providing healing for some people. And I loved hearing her share about the fact that we're not defined by our illnesses or our limitations or our shortcomings, but that Jesus determines our identity and he has called us his children. I think that's just such a key insight into what Jesus wants to know about ourselves. He made us family. That's really cool. But today in our text, we're going to see an entirely different facet of who Jesus is. And it's a display of immense power. It's frightening. Frightened the disciples. You see, most of us have seen some ferocious storms. I'm sure the disciples had too. But I would venture to suggest that none of us have seen a person calm such a storm with a word. And in these verses, we see Jesus do just that. And it's nothing short of amazing. So let's look at that. But before we get to the end of it, let's start at the beginning, okay? Verse 35. It's a very short text, and there's not a lot there. But for being such a short section of text, there's a whole lot of detail in there. Did you notice some of the kind of odd little tidbits that are in this little bit of story? I mean, for instance, we know that this event took place at the evening hour, because that's what Mark tells us. That's verse 35. And we're also told that Jesus got into a boat, but several other boats decide to follow along. It just apparently a little tidbit that they wanted to add in there. And then we learn that Jesus got into the back of the boat, not the front of the boat, not the middle of the boat. He's in the back, and his head's on a cushion. He's actually asleep with his head on a cushion in the back of the boat. A lot of inconsequential detail in a very short section of Scripture. And so a question that I had as I was reading it, maybe you do as well, what's the significant, you know, factor in relaying all these little things? Well, I've learned as I've studied through this, and I hope to help you understand that they are quite significant. Many of us, we hear this story, and on first blush, we're prone to think that it's simply a legend, that this is legend. This is not feasible. This is not possible. People don't do what Jesus does in the story, so it must be exaggeration. It must be, you know, a tall tale. Like, you know, Jack and the Beanstalk or Paul Bunyan, you know, probably an account of somebody's life that actually existed, but, you know, an exaggerated thing. It's a legend. And maybe that would be the case if it weren't for all of these details. You look at them again. You know, if you're writing up a legend, why would you write about, you know, some boats that came along with you that don't add to the story? They're not, like, advancing the story in any way. Nothing further happens with the boats. They're just mentioned. And, you know, Jesus' head on a pillow. Does it matter that his head's on a pillow? No, that doesn't really matter. Does it matter that it's evening? Probably not. It's just there are these descriptive terms and items for us to decipher and to think through it. And the most obvious explanation to me for why they exist is because they're somebody's memories. They didn't just, you know, conjure them up. It's because these things happen. The only reason that they would be included is if somebody remembered it that way. Oh, yeah, remember we were getting into the boat and all the other boats decided to come with us. You remember that? Yeah, okay, that's right. Oh, and Jesus, he was in the back of the boat. Not only he's in the middle of the boat, but for some reason he's in the back. They amount all these details to me to firsthand eyewitness memories of an actual event. That's how they strike me. And there's another thing that you should know about writing in that time. You know, unlike today when we write fiction and people include little details like this because it adds perhaps some kind of real life kind of factor to a story, that wasn't the way that they wrote in the time of Jesus. They didn't write legends with inconsequential details. They were supposed to be these kind of mega stories that illustrated a theme or spoke to something. That you didn't add inconsequential detail in that time. And so it can't be a legend if it's not written like a legend, which it's not. And there's no other reason for the detail to be included unless it actually happened. Now, why is it important for me to say that? Why does that matter? Well, I think the average New Englander would say, you know, just the average person on the street, when it comes to Jesus, they would probably say, you know, I don't know about this. How can we really know that the information in the Bible is the original Jesus? How can we know that? We can't really know, right? I mean, how can we know what he was like? All we know, probably, right, is that the church came up with these legends of Jesus, a person, no doubt, but they kind of exaggerated for their own ends and means as time went on. But we can't really know the real Jesus. It's just legends, right? That's the average, I'm guessing, take on what Jesus' life is about in the stories in the Bible. But the only problem with that theory is that the four accounts of Jesus' life, of which Mark is just one, there's also Matthew, Luke, and John, the actual accounts of Jesus' life, they don't jive with that view, that theory, that this is just exaggeration. Now, for the first part, the Gospels were written too early in the period of time after Jesus died to be legendary, because eyewitnesses were still alive when they were being written. And it'd be very easy to contradict an exaggerated legendary kind of tale. Well, that didn't happen. That's not how it went down. I was there. That's not what took place. You know, people would have poked holes in this left and right when the apostles and the writers of Scripture wrote down this account of, they could have easily poked holes in this. But more importantly even than that, is that they were written with details that were totally uncommon to the writing style of that day. And so either these are firsthand accounts, or Mark, the gospel writer here, 2,000 years ago, without any precedent for this kind of writing, and no successors for at least another 1,000, 1,500 years before people start writing fiction like we know it today, unless he somehow anticipated modern narrative fiction writing, then this has to be an actual accounting. You know, Mark either began a style of writing of fiction like we would today in a vacuum and just kind of appeared and then it never appeared again for another 1,500 years, or it actually took place. Do you see? Which one do you think sounds more plausible? Well, I've obviously got a stake in this. I believe this account in Mark took place. That's my standpoint. The power of Jesus is not just the power that comes to us internally when we read an inspiring story about what he taught or what he did. I believe that this power that is demonstrated in this account happened in real time in history. I believe it happened. And maybe your question is, well, why does that matter? What does it matter that I believe that? Maybe you're not there yet. Because some people would say, you know, I like the Christian stuff. You know, I like this idea that God provides grace. I like the idea that we as people should dispense grace too. I like that we should be a loving people, honest. I like the morality, perhaps. But there's some things that, you know, that some of us don't like too, you know, and I exclude some of the miracles because that's just fantasy, and I exclude some of the things Jesus taught because I really don't agree with that, and but hold on for a second. See, either Jesus wasn't raised from the dead in real time historically, and so we can believe whatever we want, and we can pick and choose the stuff that we like about what Jesus said and kind of take the rest and leave it, or he was indeed raised historically. And if that's the case, then there's no picking and choosing of the parts that we like or dislike. I mean, if this actually happened, then we have to reckon with every facet of Jesus, not just the parts that we like or agree with. There's not a negotiation of the good parts and the bad parts. It's just we have to deal with the whole picture. And I realize that in a room this size, that some of you probably are not all the way there yet with Jesus. You are not sold. And I am really glad you're here. I think it's awesome that you're here. I hope that you study. I hope that you examine. I hope that you investigate. And that's the whole purpose for our existence as a church, is to help give you an opportunity to do just that. And my intention is not to try and preemptively force your hand. I'm not trying to say, hey, today's the day. Here's the line. Cross it or stay over there. That's not my intent. I want you to continue to press into who Jesus is. But I would be remiss not to take apart the arguments against Jesus' divinity that simply don't wash with historical accounts. I hope that's fair. Can you give me that? Because you might not be all the way there on who Jesus is, but you should not base your opinion of him on wishy-washy facts about his life. Now, I understand that this story of Jesus' power is a remarkable one. I do. But if it's true, then there's clearly one understanding that we must take away. I don't know if you like to write stuff down, but this would be the thing that I feel like is the intent of Jesus performing this magnificent act of power. If we're going to trust Jesus when we encounter the storms in this life, then we're going to need to know that this really happened. We need to trust that Jesus will be there for us in the storms of this life. And the only way that we can truly put all of our chips in on this is if a story about Jesus' power is every bit as true as the teaching on mercy and grace that he provides for us. If we're going to have the confidence in who Jesus is for us in this life when we go through a tough time, then this has to be true. We need for this to be true. And look at the last words that are spoken in our text. The disciples are saying to one another, "Who is this man? Even the wind and the waves obey him." And the answer is, Jesus is someone who has virtually infinite power. He has awesome power. A couple things you need to know about the Sea of Galilee. I want to give you some context for this story so that you can begin to kind of put yourself there and envision what happened. The Sea of Galilee is it's about 750 feet below sea level. It's a very low place on this earth. And yet just 30 miles away from the Sea of Galilee to the north is a mountain called Mount Hermon, which rises nearly 10,000 feet above sea level. And so within the span of just 30 miles, you get this wild fluctuation in altitude from 10,000-foot-high peaks all the way down to 750 feet below sea level, a lake, you know, a big body of water. And consequently, you have a constant clash of cold and warm air in that environment. And the Sea of Galilee today, as has always been the case, produces a lot of severe weather, storms. And it's known for storms. And if you're a fisherman like the disciples were, you know, Jesus' disciples, many of them were seasoned fishermen. They had lived on this particular body of water for most of their lives out in boats. They were certainly used to this kind of bad weather. They knew that storms would come on this in this Sea of Galilee. And so this particular storm must have been an exceptionally fierce squall, because as experienced as they were, they thought that they were going to die. They thought that this was it. We're going down with the ship. And they don't wake up Jesus and say, "Master, we might die. You should wake up because this is getting serious." They wake him and they say, "Teacher, we are going to drown. We are in the process right now of dying, and you are asleep." And so this must have been an incredible storm, because they're scared. I mean, they have probably, it says in the text that the boat is filling up with water. They've no doubt been bailing against the waves that are crashing in, and they've just given up on the fact that they can actually outpace the storm. They're going down. They wake Jesus up. And I love what, in the book, Jesus the King, I love what Tim Keller says about what happens next. Okay, so Jesus, his head's on a cushion, you know, very blissful rest. They wake him up, and he does two things next that are just amazing. The first is the shocking simplicity of what he says. Take note. Jesus does not stand back. Clear some space, everyone. doesn't roll up his sleeves, break out the magic wand, and conjure some fantastical incantation. In the name of, you know, he doesn't do it, no dramatics, nothing ostentatious, no like big display of, you know, bravado. He simply stands up and he says two very simple verb words. The first of which is very common, the second which is a little unusual. It's a present progressive. Here's what Jesus says in essence. He says, be quiet, stay quiet. That's it. He says that to a hurricane. Now, that's the way you'd talk to a kid who's misbehaving. Hey, be still, be quiet, get over there. You know, that's what my grandpa, I was remembering this in first service. My grandpa, I have this memory when I was on a couch with him when I was a little kid of him saying, be quiet, be still. And that's exactly how I said it. That's the kind of stuff that you say to a kid. And Jesus, he's talking to a hurricane saying, simply, be quiet, be still. That's the first amazing thing because that's crazy. But the second amazing thing is the storm actually does it. It gets quiet and still, like a child, just like that. And if you read carefully, you'll notice that the wind died down, but that's not all. It also became completely calm. That's what it's describing. And that might just sound redundant unless you realize that it's talking about the wind and the sea. The second phrase, you know, there was great calm. It's the word for dead calm. Anybody ever experienced dead calm on a large body of water? Do you know what that is? That's when the water is completely still. It's smooth as glass. There's not a ripple. You can see reflection in the water perfectly. So do you know what happened? Jesus said, be quiet and stay quiet. And the first thing is the wind stops. But you know, that could have just been a coincidence. You know, it could have just been happenstance. You know, maybe the wind just stopped. If you've ever been near the ocean, you know that when the wind stops, you know, the waves keep crashing in. If you've been near the ocean during a big storm, the big booming waves can still come in long after the storm has passed. But when Jesus said, be quiet and stay quiet, not only did the wind stop, you know, which could have been coincidental, but the ocean suddenly went dead calm, just raging storm is reduced to nil with the power of Jesus' voice. Do you know what this means? I think it means that Jesus is not someone who simply has power. I think it means that Jesus defines what power is. He's power himself. Any person or anything in the universe that has power simply has it on loan from Jesus. And that's an amazing statement, I know. It pushes us right to the edge on who he might be. But you see, this happened. The disciples remember it happening. It has all the earmarks of eyewitness reporting. And if it happened, then who is this man? And that's the question the disciples were asking themselves. Who is this guy? Who is this guy? I mean, can I show you one of the more humorous parts of the story for me? This is the part that kind of makes me smile a little bit. I mean, look at the emotions of the disciples before Jesus calms the storm. I mean, they're freaked out. They're scared. I mean, they're terrified. But after Jesus calms the storm, they're even more terrified. They're more frightened. And why? Why would you go from scared to absolute, you know, terror? I think this is why. You see, the men wake Jesus up, and the text says that the boat has nearly been swamped, and so they're all about to go down with the ship, so they're waking him up, asking him, don't you care that we're going to drown? And anyone who's attempted a life of faith, you know, for those of us who are trying to trust God with our lives, this has to hit us square in the heart, because anyone who's attempted to live a life like that has felt like this at some point. Feel like we're sinking, everything's going wrong, God's asleep. My life it's in a shambles right now. Things are falling apart around the edges. Where's God? What's going on? Why is he not putting an end to this? Why is he not fixing this. Where is he? And the disciples, they wake Jesus up and they say, you've gone asleep at the hour of our greatest need. Don't you care? Because if you loved us, surely you wouldn't be letting us go through this. And we say the same stuff. God, if you love me, you wouldn't be putting me through this. God, how can you let me face this? Why can't you put a stop to it? Why are you allowing me to experience this pain, this death, this life of difficulty? And what does Jesus do? Calms the storm, sure, and that's no small thing. But then what does he say? Does he say, I can understand how you guys feel. Man, that was scary, wasn't it? That was crazy. I mean, the water, that was awesome. No wonder you guys are so scared. Unfortunately, no, that is not what he says. He actually says, why were you afraid? Seriously? Why were you afraid? Right? Did the waves, you know, the ones kind of in the water, and why were we afraid? We're doubting God's love for us in this life because we experience trouble. And Jesus says, guess what? Your premise is wrong. We should know better than this. You see, God does allow people that he loves to go through storms. He does. You want to know why the disciples are more terrified after Jesus has calmed the storm? It's because he's as unmanageable as the storm itself. Storm has incredible power. Can't be controlled or contained. But Jesus has more power. No one's going to control him. So you may ask yourself, what's the difference? You know, I would no sooner put my trust in a storm than I would Jesus if that's the way it's going to be. But there's a huge difference, and it's this. The storm doesn't love you, but Jesus does. It's true that Jesus, quite like the storms that we encounter in this life, he is completely unmanageable. He lets things happen to us that we don't understand. I don't understand. I don't understand the things that happen in this life. I can't pretend to explain a rhyme or a reason for every event that happens in our lives. He doesn't do things according to plan, certainly not my plans. He doesn't do things in a way that makes sense to me. But if Jesus is God, with the ability to subdue nature with a word of his power, then he must also be great enough to allow us to go through things that we don't have the ability to understand. So Jesus, like nature, is completely unmanageable. But what's the difference? Well, it's all the difference in the world because Jesus is filled with love for you. When the disciples were being reproved, you know, Jesus is asking them why they were afraid. What he was really saying, what he was asking them to consider, what was understanding just how much he loved them could get them through any storm. Didn't mean he was going to remove every storm, but his love for them would get them through the storms that they encountered. Jesus can and he does allow us to endure storms in this life because he is God and he knows better than we do. And I love there's this excerpt in the book Keller writes, and he's quoting Elizabeth Elliot, and she says this marvelous thing. It's on the screen for you. She says, God is God, and since he is God, he's worthy of my worship and my service. I will find rest nowhere else but in his will. And that will is necessarily, infinitely, immeasurably, unspeakably beyond my largest notions of what he's up to. Who can understand the ways of God? Who, you know, he has this argument with Job, reminding Job that, you know, hey, where were you when I laid the foundations of this earth? You know, where were you when I, you know, set the stars in their places and put everything in its order? Where were you? He is infinitely beyond our understanding of his will. And that much we understand. I think that much makes sense to us because this world is big and vast and we understand things out of our control. But how do we know that he also loves us? You see, there, that's the important question. Because getting our minds around a God who created this world, you know, that we can get to. But how do we also know that he loves us? Because in the storms of this life, I don't know if you're like me, but it's very easy to lose perspective on God's care for me when I'm going through that kind of thing. Well, on this measure, I think there's a firm record for us to place our trust. Jesus was not content simply to teach or heal or calm storms. And while those endeavors brought resolution to some temporary needs, they were not sufficient to meet our deepest need. Jesus chooses not to calm every storm in particular in our life, but he did calm the greatest storm that we face, the one for each of us that is the most deadly, the most dangerous. You see, Jesus, he proved the depth of his affection for us when he willingly faced the cross on our behalf. He, who lived a life that we could never live, you know, he was perfect. He didn't have any blemish. He was holy and pure. And yet, this man chose to take the punishment that we deserved for our imperfection, for our sin, for our disobedience. He bore our sin, though he knew no sin himself, so that we could experience life and forgiveness and joy. And we're reconciled to God through Christ. When he rose from the dead, Jesus proved that he is truly our Savior. He is worthy of our worship. He can do more than calm storms. That would be awesome in and of itself. But not only that, he grants life to those who choose to place their trust in him. He might not calm every storm in particular of your life, but he has calmed the most significant one for each of us. Out of the depth of his love for us, he took our sin and he wiped it away. And he paid the punishment for us so that we could know forgiveness. I'm struck by the fact that every time the disciples truly get an unfiltered look at Jesus' power, they always recoil in terror. One of the most common utterances in Scripture is, "Do not be afraid." And that's because people are constantly afraid in their encounters with the power of God. And the disciples, they're just kind of par for the course. You know, here, they Jesus calms the storm, and after the storm is calmed, they're even more terrified. The transfiguration, you know, Jesus is appearing in all his glory, and they are just looking for a bush somewhere to hide in. Even the resurrection, this reuniting with Jesus, who is alive after they saw him die and they put him in a tomb, they're still in fear. There's something about that strikes me as a great consolation. You know, Jesus is always the same. You know, he doesn't miss a beat in any of the stories. He just continues to press forward. He is on mission. He's content to let his followers catch up to him, even if their faith is not as fully realized as he would hope it to be. And what does that mean for me and for you? Well, I hope it's some solace to know that even those who walked with Jesus lacked the faith he was looking for at times. Not because it somehow diminishes our need to trust Christ. We still need to trust Christ with all our hearts. But simply because it proves that there's a learning curve. You know, if nothing else, this proves there's an arc to this thing, you know? And it is a progression, and it's not expected of us that we just have it down pat, rock solid, everything's locked down, no doubts, no worries, I got it. I take great consolation in the fact that the guys who knew Jesus best still didn't have it all figured out for a good time. They had to walk with them for more days, more hours. They had to listen to him. They had to endure some things, and their faith was strengthened. And ultimately, they laid their lives on the line for this message of Christ. You know, all this is just crazy stories, right? If the disciples choose to kind of just go on living their lives and doing nothing. These guys laid their lives on the line for this. They died because they trusted that God had done something for them in Christ. that was so remarkable, so amazing. He provided grace. He rose from the dead. And when we put our trust in him all these years later, what's true for the disciples is still true for us. It radically changes our hearts. It allows us to endure the very difficult things of this life. And I don't discount the fact that some of us are enduring difficult times. And God doesn't take away every storm. He permits some. But he is with us through those storms. And he has conquered the one that was the most violent for us by his love for us on the cross. Do not lose sight of that. If your hold on Christ seems tenuous at times because the violence of the wind and the waves is shaking your confidence, don't lose heart. He certainly has not. And he continues to love and to intervene on our behalf. Let's pray about that. God, thank you for this wild passage. It's a passage that begs belief for all of us, really. I mean, it's fantastical. I'm grateful for it because as I've come to understand that it's true and reliable testimony myself, it's helped me so much to understand that you are capable of so much more than I am. Your power is extreme. It's amazing. It's sufficient for me to rely on. But not only that, you've loved me. You love us. Your concern for us goes beyond simple interest or a passing fancy of how we're getting along. You put yourself on the line for us. You paid the penalty that we deserved. And I don't always understand why you let us go through tough times. I don't pretend to have your perspective, but I am grateful for the knowledge that you care for us and that your love for us has the potential to change everything about how we go through the difficulties of this life. Father, help us to rely on you. Give us courage to face what you put in front of us in this life with faith and with trust. And you fill us with your spirit and with wisdom to become people who are maybe not unaffected by storms, but confident in spite of them that you are working your plan to perfection and we're a part of that good plan. Father, do in us and through us what you want. We are available to you because we want to put our trust in the one who can control the seas with a word of power and who could shed his blood for us because of an infinite amount of love. And we thank you for that in Jesus' name.